Well, we finally finished James chapter 2, so this evening we're going to start chapter 3. It's not the third year we've been here, but it is the third chapter of the book. This is not an old overhead, it's a brand new overhead, but it's an old truth that we've been reviewing as we've been dealing with James, because you know that I believe that the book of James has as its basic thesis the principles of dealing with temptation effectively. Temptation or trial is the opening section of chapter 1, and it's the closing section of chapter 5, and in between it, there are three major movements of thought that deal, I believe, with John's categories of the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life. And I drew this with these cannons shooting the cannonball. The wall of faith is here, but there is an explosive power of unbelief that destroys our capacity to resist this kind of onslaught unless we lock in on what God has said and believe it and stand according to it. Otherwise, the disbelief or the unbelief allows the onslaught to tear through the wall of the sanctuary of our lives. And our lives are supposed to be operated on the basis of the love of the Father, but way too many times we get sidetracked from that, and we discover that there have been breaches in the wall that we're supposed to maintain as we try to live by faith. So in the last month, we have been dealing with this issue of the lust of the eyes in chapter 2, where the main focus of the lust of the eyes is the focus on the acquisition of material things. But the acquisition of material things has as its motive the provision of security for the soul. These are theological realities, but they're illustrated by Jesus' temptation, the temptation, Genesis 3 of Adam and Eve. But the point simply is that in chapter 2, he was dealing with the lust of the eyes, and he basically emphasized the fact that we need to exercise a faith that is productive. We need to lock in on what Jesus has promised about our own security, that we're not supposed to try to make our lives consist of the abundance of the things we possess, because we can't do that. We're supposed to recognize that he has promised, I will be with you till the end of the age. There's nothing that we have to fear, because he has promised to be with us in the circumstances of our lives, so that we really do not have any foundation for worry, and there isn't any reason why we should feel insecure. And when we do feel insecure, we're susceptible to the onslaught of the lust of the eye. But as we move into chapter 3, where he deals primarily in the chapter with the use of the tongue, the first 12 verses are focused on the exercise of the tongue, and the last 6 verses, verses 13 through 18, challenges the definition of true wisdom. But in all of this, I think there is an underlying focus, and it has to do with the pride of life, because the use of the tongue is primarily instrumental in trying to promote ourselves, in many cases, to elevate ourselves, which is what the pride of life is all about. So this evening what we're going to do is we're going to begin the study of this chapter 3 by looking into the opening statement that James makes. I want to clarify my understanding of chapter 3 as a focus on the pride of life by saying a couple of things about that. The pride of life in John's categories in 1 John should probably be translated the arrogance of functional capacity, because that's what the words translated the pride of life, the arrogance of the kind of life that is defined as functional capacity. There is a deep-seated drive in man to be recognized, to be significant in the eyes of people on the basis of what he's done. Our culture is shot through with all of that. The appeal to the super sports, all of the people that are involved in athletic activities, almost all of them will tell you that there is nothing quite like the thrill of the adrenaline of the flow when everybody's cheering for them. And all that is the desire to be somebody in the eyes of people. The pride of life is probably the thing that drives most of the political stuff in this country, because it's a desire to be on top and to control things and to be the one that's important. And Jesus even said that the kings of this world rule, lord it over. That's the way it is. It's driven by this arrogance of, look what I can do, look what I have done. However, this drive to be recognized or to have status in the eyes of somebody is a fundamental drive that you can't escape. The problem of pushing for recognition is actually the root of what we call secular humanism, which is rampant in our culture today, where men are have dismissed God and are claiming that they have the ability to control their lives and to control ours too. But the focus on the arrogance of functional capacity is actually the root for the development of the coming of the Antichrist. It's the foundation of the original sin by Satan and his rebellion. It's a diabolical thing. The temptation to seek status from men is something that believers have absolutely no business pursuing, but many of us do it anyway. I think that the church in America has been riddled by men who wanted to build empires and be somebody, be recognized as effective, and our whole culture is shot through with this. It's just everywhere. James sees the problem in James 3 as a problem that drives the tongue. And one of the things that I want us to be aware of is that the drive for status can only be handled one of two ways. You can either believe you've already got it, which means you believe that Christ died for you. That means that you believe the God who made you values you enough to die for you, and that makes you as important as you can get. You can either get your sense of significance by faith that way, or you will be trying to do it on the basis of how well you do things. And how well you do things eventually will come out in the way you talk about yourself and others. So that's the background for chapter 3 as he starts it out. Actually, what he says in verse 1 is quite a shock and basically ignored by the vast majority of believers. It says, pointedly, "Let not many of you become teachers, my brethren, knowing that as such we shall incur stricter judgment." In the church today, we don't discourage people from being teachers. We try to encourage them to become teachers. We beg and plead for people to be teachers. We do what we can to try to motivate people to get plugged in. And here James says, don't. So it's kind of a shock to see him say that. And so this evening what we want to do is we want to start by looking at some of the background that's involved in this matter of his restricting the issue of teaching. We've mentioned a couple of these things, or at least one of them, the historical reality thing, but I'd like to start here. When James says, "Let not many of you become teachers, my brethren," he obviously is looking at this from the perspective of the motivation of the individual. In the synagogues or churches that he is writing to, people who want to be in the limelight of the ministry of the local church. That's what often drives the desire to be a teacher, to be the one up there who's in the limelight, who's telling people what it is, how it is, and so on, so on, so on. And James doesn't deal much in this entire book with the doctrine and theology of the Holy Spirit. And I think that part of the reason for that is simply that the outpouring of the Spirit was so fresh in terms of the experience that James didn't feel a need to refer to it, because it was something that had just happened within the last few years at Pentecost, and it was such a powerful demonstration of the power of God, and the gifts of the Spirit were being exercised in all of the assemblies and so on, that he probably felt like he could assume that in what he has to say. I'm making that assumption because he doesn't say a whole lot about the Spirit and the work of the Spirit and the ministry of the Spirit. But I want to turn you back for a minute or two or three to 1 Corinthians chapters 12 through 14. There are a couple of passages in there that have to do with this matter of a person becoming a teacher in the local church. One of them is in chapter 12, verses 8 to 11. And I want to read over those and make a comment or two about it. It says in verse 11 of 1 Corinthians 12, "To one is given the word of wisdom through the Spirit, and to another the word of knowledge according to the same Spirit, to another faith by the same Spirit, and to another gifts of healing by the one Spirit, and to another the effecting of miracles, and to another prophecy, and to another the distinguishing of spirits, to another various kinds of tongues, and to another the interpretation of tongues. But," verse 11, "one and the same Spirit works all these things, distributing to each one individually just as he wills." Now, on the basis of what Paul wrote here in 1 Corinthians 12, we should understand this. that it is the Spirit of God who determines who's going to be the teachers in the church. He determines it by gifting. According to this text, the ability to exercise that spiritual gifting is directly dependent upon the selection and ministry of the Spirit of God. He distributes the gifts to the individuals as he chooses. Now, that's particularly important because, hold your finger there, we're going to come back to 1 Corinthians, but I want you to go to 1 Peter chapter 4 and look at something that Peter said about this matter of exercising your spiritual giftedness. In 1 Peter chapter 4, he says in verses 10 and 11, as each one has received a special gift, employ it in serving one another as good stewards of the manifold grace of God. Whoever speaks, let him speak, as it were, the utterances of God. Whoever serves, let him do so as by the strength which God supplies, so that in all things God may be glorified through Jesus Christ, to whom belongs the glory and the dominion forever and ever. Now notice, the glory is supposed to go to Jesus. Status seekers can't let the glory go to Jesus. They've got to have it for themselves. But I want you to notice what he said in verse 10. The employment of your spiritual gift is a matter of good stewardship. A person who is not exercising their spiritual giftedness is not a good steward. And therefore, when he talks about receiving these gifts of the Spirit and employing them, we do it as stewards. But for what purpose? According to verse 10, in serving one another. So that if we speak, we're to speak as the utterances of God. If we serve, we're supposed to serve by the strength which God supplies. Now, when we tie that with what Paul taught in 1 Corinthians 12, what we come up with is this very clear reality, that the Spirit of God gives the gifts of the Spirit to individuals as he chooses, but once he gives them, then they become our stewardship responsibility. Now, go over to 1 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 31, and then chapter 14, verse 1. He says in chapter 12, verse 31, earnestly desire the greater gifts. And then in chapter 14, verse 1, pursue love, yet desire earnestly spiritual gifts, but especially that you may prophesy. Now, Paul is telling the people in Corinth that they should long to be able to do this. But James says in James chapter 3, verse 1, don't seek to be teacher. At least, don't many of you seek to be a teacher? How do we pull this together? Believers are urged to earnestly desire to have the ability to edify the body, but they're supposed to be doing that as stewards of the gifting that they've been given. And if teaching happens to be their gift, they have to be a teacher to be a faithful steward. But James obviously isn't addressing those people when he says, don't many of you become teachers, because he wouldn't at all try to dissuade somebody whose spiritual gifting was in that area not to do it. So given that reality, we have to understand that Paul's gift concept of ministry, that you have been gifted to minister, and if your gifting is teaching, then that's what you've got to do. But what if your gifting's not teaching, but you still want to be a teacher? You have to ask yourself, why? Why do you want to be what you're not? You know, there have been a lot of us enthusiasts who have gone into Bible college to go to into ministry who always idolize, we want to be like Billy Graham. Why? Well, I have a sneaking hunch that a very small group of us want to be like Billy Graham because we want to win people to Christ. But there's a whole lot of others who want to be like Billy Graham because there's thousands and thousands of people who listen when he speaks. And the one is a legitimate motive and the other is a carnal, status-driven motive. So, James is not trying to contradict what Paul is teaching. But he is putting the brakes on something that's going on in the synagogues and churches to whom he's addressing this letter because of the situation that I'm going to call the historical reality. The book of James had to have been written sometime in the period that was covered by Acts 8 through 10. because it's obviously post-Pentecost. He's writing to the people who believe that Jesus is the Messiah, but they're scattered into various places. But it's also obvious, since he addresses them as of the 12 tribes, that there are no Gentiles in this, and therefore the gospel hasn't broken through the Gentile barrier yet, which happened at Cornelius' house in Acts 10. So James wrote his epistle within this historical framework, and the thing that's important about that is simply this. When James wrote this letter, the church was under severe persecution. And being persecuted, it was not popular to be identified with Jesus as the Christ, which meant that, culturally speaking, you could not achieve any status in the eyes of men in your culture. You couldn't. As soon as you identified yourself as a believer in Yeshua as the Messiah, you were not going to get any status. In fact, you were going to be humiliated. You were going to be dragged down in their eyes, because you were the persecuted super minority. Which meant that for anybody who still wanted status but couldn't get in this culture, where was he going to go to get it? Well, there are only two places you could go. One of them is to the Lord, by faith, accepting your status as a consequence of the declaration of the gospel that Jesus died for you. You can get it that way and be satisfied. Or you can get it the only other place that's available, and that's in the church. If your culture won't give it to you because you've identified yourself with Jesus as the Messiah, but you still are really weak in your confidence that your significance stands or falls on the basis of the truth of the gospel, if you're not really solid on that, then what you're going to do is you're going to move into the area where you can be recognized for what you do, and there's only one place, and that's in the church. And when you look around in the church to see who's got the status in the eyes of the people, who is it? It's the people in the limelight. There's no escape from that. Therefore, there were a group of people, apparently, that James recognized in verses 1 to 12, that were using their pursuit of a teaching ministry in the church as a status base for themselves. And the reason why I say that is, notice what it says in verse 14 of this chapter. If you have bitter jealousy and selfish ambition in your heart. And then in verse 16, where jealousy and selfish ambition exist, there's disorder in every evil thing. So James is assuming that there is bitter jealousy and selfish ambition that's driving this desire to be a teacher. Ooh. How would you like to sit under the ministry of somebody whose motivation was like that? How do you know you're not? But my point is simply, you could recognize real quickly that if a person's motivation is jealousy and selfish ambition, how much of the true word of God are you going to get? You're only going to get those portions that will somehow bring the glory back to yourself. That's all you're going to get. And what that'll end up doing is a distortion. You won't even get taught the Bible portions that humiliate the teacher. In fact, he may even start turning the statements of Scripture into meaning something altogether different, just so that he can have what he's looking for in terms of selfish ambition. So the theological reality is that man is driven to possess status. He can't escape that drive by any means. It is impossible to not be driven to desire status, and that means that then you have to satisfy it, but there's two ways you can satisfy it. One of them is by faith, where you accept your status from God as a grant. The other is by works, which is a demonic, diabolical methodology that's driven by selfish ambition. And so when James says, don't many of you seek to be or become teachers, he's not addressing those who are honestly gifted by the Spirit and are motivated by the Spirit to pursue that. He's addressing those whose, we would call it in the 20th century, whose self-esteem is so bad. I mean, that's what our culture would say. Our self-esteem is so low that we have to pump it up by being in the front of people. And that's a bad deal. So based on the fact that Paul taught gifting and the fact that in the historical setting, the only way you could get status by your works was in the church as a believer, he said, become not many of you teachers. He wanted the teachers in the church to be properly motivated, and he knew that if they were properly motivated, they would function properly by gifting. I've gone through Bible college and seminary, and I've listened to guys who had aspirations for ministry, and I have noted on occasion that I didn't think that they were gifted for what they were going after. And then I began to wonder, why are they going after it? So we come to the command, let not many of you become teachers, my brethren. The command is actually a demand that teaching in the church be driven by a sense of divine necessity and not by a sense of personal need. In other words, I believe that the visible ministries in the church, the high visible ministries which are so prone to being abused, those should only be fulfilled by calling. I've told many young men particularly, if you can do anything else besides vocational ministry, do that. Why? Because you got to have a sense of calling or else your motivation's off. And that's what he's saying here. You need to be driven by a sense of divine necessity, not by a sense of personal need. My significance tank is low. I need to be in front of people for a while. No. If your significance tank is low, you need to go back to Jesus. You need to go back to Calvary. You need to look again at the fact that your God died for you. That ought to fill up your tank. I think we should take this forbidding of many to be teachers at face value. Whether to be a teacher in the church or not to be a teacher in the church is not to be decided without a clear understanding that the position is not an optional issue for the person who's gifted for it, and it's not even an option for the person who's not. If spiritual gifting means that you're a teacher, then you don't have an option if you want to be a good steward. But at the same time, if your gifting is not in teaching, it's not an option for you to be a teacher. God doesn't intend that for you. The very fact that he says not many of you become teachers means that the majority of people in the church are not called by God to the task of being a teacher in the church. And then that's obvious. I mean, there's always going to be more people than there are teachers. It's always going to be that way. I have noticed that there are two ways that people sometimes aspire to be a teacher by becoming. It says not many of you become. Some of them do it by an appeal to intellectualism. We had a letter to the editor in this week's paper by a guy who wanted to use his intellectualism as a self-promoting thing. It was obvious from the way he was writing. Nobody could understand what he was writing except highly intellectual people, or you had to get your dictionary down and start going through the words. Well, why would anybody write a letter to the editor like that unless he's trying to draw attention to himself? Well, same thing is true, though, in the church. Sometimes people aspire to be teachers, and they do it by multiplying degrees. They die by degrees. But they might even get a doctor of theology degree so that they can do this, so they can be in the limelight, and all the while God's not gifted them for that. But on the other hand, there are those who don't want to go that route. They don't want to have to be in the bother. They just want to be in the limelight, so they're anti-intellectual. And they scoff at all the teaching, and they talk about people that have died by degrees. And so what they end up doing is not teaching the church anything and dumbing down everything until nobody can learn anything. Well, both of those methods are just methods of people trying to be something they're not. We need to be really comfortable with what we've been gifted for and be satisfied. The forbidding to be a teacher should only be overridden if there's a sense of compulsion from God that cannot be denied. I left the ministry once thinking I'm never going to be a pastor again. I couldn't live with it. It wasn't because of the status. It was because God had gifted me for this, and he said, you're going to do this. If you want to be faithful to me, you're going to do this. Well, I want to be faithful to him, but I don't often want to do this. So, at any rate, on the other hand, there is a good reason why we shouldn't seek to be a teacher unless, of course, that's our gifting and stewardship. And the reason is because in verse 1 it says, we shall incur a stricter judgment. Being a teacher is being subject to rather large liability. It's true that God holds people liable according to the privilege granted. If he grants you the opportunity to exercise one of the more visible gifts, he's going to hold you more strictly accountable. And that's one reason we've seen so many evangelicals go down the drain, because they were not being faithful and God took them down. He allowed their weaknesses and their failures to come to light and brought them down. He'll do that because he holds us to a stricter accountability. Now, he doesn't do it nearly as fast as he ought to as far as some of us are concerned. You know, we wonder, why has he let this go on for so long? But he does. He brings people down when they have exalted themselves. 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 17 pointedly declares that there are serious consequences for corrupting the church. Serious. 2 Corinthians chapter 5, verses 9 to 11 pointedly declares that there's a valid basis for fear in the face of the Bema seat. You don't do your job. 1 Corinthians 11 says that divine judgment, even to death, can come upon believers for being unfaithful. And then, of course, 1 John 2 says that we should walk with him, abide in him, so that we will not be humiliated before him at his coming, which means being humiliated before him is a possibility. And then James point blankly just says, people who teach, and he includes himself there, and I have to include myself there, we're responsible for what we tell you, folks. And if you believe what we tell you and what we told you is a lie, God's going to hold us accountable. He'll also hold you accountable, because the Bereans were, in their nobility, they searched the scriptures to see if what they were being taught was true. And that's a personal responsibility we all have. But the teachers are going to be held accountable. There is a hierarchy of judgment upon believers, and greater judgment falls on those who wield greater influence. And quite frankly, teachers wield the strongest influence in the church nowadays, because there are no more apostles and there are no more prophets, as far as we can tell. And that leaves teaching as the final. That's where the truth or the lack of truth comes. And therefore, teaching becomes the most critical issue. And therefore, teachers are going to be judged the most severely. And that's true. Sometimes the judgment is in time, and sometimes it waits until the Bema seat, but it's nonetheless going to be there. So, the opening statement in chapter 3, where he addresses this matter of our desire to be somebody in the eyes of somebody, where we use our tongues to do that, to elevate ourselves, he says, absolutely not. Absolutely not. If you're going to be a teacher, it needs to be by divine compulsion, by a spiritual gifting, and for no other reason. Now, as we go on to the rest of the chapter in the weeks to come, we're going to squirm because he deals with the tongue here. Like he says, if anybody's able to bridle the tongue, he's perfect. So as we go through the rest of this, we're going to find that we use our tongues to exalt ourselves, and it's never legitimate. Never. We're supposed to only speak in words that minister grace to the hearer. All of our speech is supposed to be restricted to whether we're ministering grace to the hearer. But I know that a vast block of the stuff I say doesn't minister grace to anybody. It's an attempt to build something for myself. And I think all of us are guilty of it, a great deal. And we need to watch the way we talk. But we particularly need to watch our motivation and desire in relation to the church as to whether we want to be a teacher or not. Because it's all driven by whether we believe that we are somebody in the eyes of God because he died for us, or whether, not believing that, we feel like we have to prove ourselves to other people so that they'll give us the recognition we want. As I said, nobody escapes the desire to be somebody. Nobody. God built that right into us. But when he built it into us, he expected us to satisfy that need by turning to him walking with him. When we turned our back on that in Genesis 3, we started looking for it in other places. Desiring to be somebody is no different than being thirsty. If you're thirsty, you need to go where the water is. If you want to be somebody, you need to go where the significance actually is, and that's in the heart and mind of God. Okay? We're out of time, been out of time for a little bit. Is there any question or comment before we quit? Well, if not, let's have a word of prayer together, and then we'll be dismissed.